Chapter 50 Laptops, Cell Phones, and Cars. 4 million people have been killed in what is euphemistically called the Democratic Republic of the Congo, formerly Zaire, since 1998. They have died so that wealthier people can buy inexpensive computers and cell phones. Although the country won its independence from Belgium in 1960, it soon fell under Washington's influence. Time magazine, in a 2006 cover story entitled The Deadliest War in the World, stated bluntly that Congo's, quote, first elected prime minister, Lumumba, had been killed by Belgian and U.S.-backed opponents because of his growing ties to the Soviet Union, unquote. After Lumumba's assassination, Army General Mobutu Sese Seko eventually took control. In Time's words, quote, a U.S. favorite during the Cold War, Mobutu presided over one of the most corrupt regimes in African history, unquote. Mobutu's long rule was ruthless, as well as corrupt, and deeply disturbing to neighboring countries. In 1996 and 1997, Rwanda and Uganda sent soldiers into Congo, overthrew Mobutu, and installed the rebel leader, Laurent Kabila, as its new president. However, social and economic conditions deteriorated rapidly under Kabila's administration. Uganda and Rwanda invaded again in 1998. Six other countries, seeing this as an opportunity to take advantage of Congo's rich resources, joined what became known as Africa's First World War. Ethnic, cultural, and tribal conflicts played a role in the war. However, mostly it is a struggle over resources. According to Time, Congo's, quote, soils are packed with diamonds, gold, copper, tantalum, known locally as coltan, and used in electronic devices such as cell phones and laptop computers, and uranium, unquote. The country is vast, about 1.5 times the size of Alaska, and is covered in many places with lush tropical forests and fertile agricultural lands. As I had discovered in conducting my studies of this region, the waters of the Congo River have the potential of providing hydroelectric power to much of the continent. Without Congo's tantalum, we would not have many of our computer-based products. For example, a tantalum shortage resulted in the scarcity of the Sony PlayStation 2 during the 2000 Christmas season. Militias from Rwanda and Uganda may justify invasions on the grounds that they are defending their people against rebels, but they earn billions of dollars from the tantalum they collect and smuggle across borders during these raids. EHMs, jackals, and government agents from the United States, the United Kingdom, and South Africa constantly flame the fires of conflict. Fortunes are made from arms sales to all sides. War enables corporations to dodge the scrutiny of human rights and environmental groups and avoid paying taxes and tariffs. Congo is but one of many places where similar things are happening. U.S. Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney, Democrat of Georgia, exposed many aspects of this Anglophone conspiracy during a hearing she chaired on April 16, 2001. Her opening statement included the following indictment. Much of what you will hear today has not been widely reported in the public media. Powerful forces have fought to suppress these stories from entering the public domain. The investigations into the activities of Western governments and Western businessmen in post-colonial Africa provide clear evidence of the West's long-standing propensity for cruelty, avarice, and treachery. The misconduct of Western nations in Africa is not due to momentary lapses, individual defects, or errors of common human frailty. Instead, they form part of long-term policy designed to access and plunder Africa's wealth at the expense of its people. At the heart of Africa's suffering is the West's, and most notably the United States' desire to access Africa's diamonds, oil, natural gas, and other precious resources. The West, and most notably the United States, has set in motion a policy of oppression, destabilization, and tempered not by moral principle, but by a ruthless desire to enrich itself on Africa's fabulous wealth. Western countries have incited rebellion against stable African governments have even actively participated in the assassination of duly elected and legitimate African heads of state and replaced them with corrupted and malleable officials. Although the United Nations has committed to halting the bloodshed in Congo in the summer of 2006, the largest UN force in the world was stationed there. The United States and other G8 countries have not cooperated. In Time magazine's words, quote, "The world has been willing to let Congo bleed. Since 2000, the UN spent billions on its peacekeeping mission in Congo. In February, the UN and aid groups working in Congo asked for $682 million in humanitarian funds. So far, they have received just $94 million, or $9.40 for every person in need." Unquote. The violence is not contained within borders. Congo's neighbor, the Darfur region of Sudan, is experiencing a similar nightmare. 2 million people have died in a war that has raged for 20 years. This one is fed in part by that most coveted of resources, oil. Although the conflict is rooted in old religious and ethnic antagonisms that reached new levels in the 1980s and 1990s, the violence has been used and exacerbated by EHMs and jackals to mask activities aimed at seizing control of the oil fields. The fighting and social turmoil also facilitate the trafficking of human beings. In recent years, roughly 250,000 Sudanese have been kidnapped as slaves. Many, like the mother of my Alexandria friends, Sammy and Samantha, sold into the sex trade. Most people in the civilized world believe that such practices ended in the 19th century. They did not. One justification for doing so little to help the Sudanese is the country's reputation as a training ground for terrorists. Sudan was the refuge of Osama bin Laden after he was expelled from Saudi Arabia in 1992 and is considered the birthplace of Al-Qaeda. It is easy for the media to write it off as an ally of the axis of evil. Congo and Sudan are examples of countries caught up in classic resource grabs. War and poverty facilitate the perpetuation of systems that exploit natural resources and cheap labor, while corrupting local politicians. Another African country offers an example of the more subtle empire-building approach, witnessed in Kenya and Uganda by Jenny Williams. The role of NGOs. In some respects, the story of two young Americans who joined the Peace Corps because they were determined to help Africans is even more shocking than Jenny's. It uncovers what some consider a conspiracy between U.S. policymakers, foreign governments, NGOs, and the huge agribusiness industry. Chapter 51. Ex-Peace Corps Volunteers Offer Hope. Mali, a landlocked country in northwest Africa, at first appears benign, one of those places no one cares about, neglected even by empire builders. That appearance is deceptive. In the deception lies a key to corporatocracy strategies on the African continent. Mali won its independence from France in 1960 and is now a republic. About a third of its people, 12 million, live in the capital city of Bamako. 80% of the workforce is employed by the agricultural sector. 90% are classified as Muslim, 9% indigenous animist, 1% Christian. It has deposits of gold, uranium, bauxite, and other minerals. Its former president, Alpha Conaré, bought the World Bank plan and implemented measures that revived the economy, primarily through cotton and gold production. He also honored a constitutional provision barring third terms. Amadou Touré was elected president with 65% of the votes in 2002. If I ask how many people in my audiences know about Mali, I almost never see a hand. However, when I spoke at a fundraiser for a public library in Dover, Vermont, a town near my New England home, I met a young couple who had lived in Mali and who loved the land and her people deeply. We corresponded after that and spent time together chatting on a terrace at my home, overlooking the Berkshire Mountains. The story Greg and Cindy told me was not merely moving. It represented so much that is beautiful, tragic, and encouraging about modern-day Africa. They bring an American voice to a country and continent that for most Americans is a blur of confusing images. Their commitment to the future, their own and their Malian friends, is inspirational. Greg Flatt was stationed in Mali as a Peace Corps volunteer from 1997 to 1999. He returned on his own in 2000 to record an album with Malian musicians. Songs from that album, Zou et Mokhtar, La Sauce, hit number one on Mali's charts, and Greg became a celebrity throughout the country. Cindy Hellman was a Peace Corps volunteer from 1999 to 2001. She met Greg while he was there recording the album. "How could I miss him?" she asked, laughing. "People recognized him everywhere. They stopped him on the streets, broke into dance, and played air guitar. Children followed him like the Pied Piper." She and Greg married 3 years later. They had joined the Peace Corps at different times, but for similar reasons. Before entering careers in the United States, they wanted to learn about other countries and cultures. They aspired to the ideal of making a contribution to the world, an ideal expressed by John F. Kennedy when he created the Peace Corps before either of them was born. They each held a vision of a better future for the family they hoped to raise one day, and they recognized that such a future had to embrace the world. Both also had long-standing interests in agriculture. Cindy grew up on a large family farm in Indiana, and Greg loved tending his mother's garden. They told me that the Peace Corps made it sound appropriate for them to accept assignments teaching Malians about farming. "We were naive enough to believe them," Greg scowled. "I felt an immediate kinship with this young couple. Through their eyes, it was easy to see why the modern empire had spread so quickly and so surreptitiously." Cindy and Greg had joined the Peace Corps with the best of motives. They figured they had skills to offer and that by working with U.S. government agencies and international organizations like the World Bank, they could help bring prosperity to Africa. Instead, they discovered they were playing a very different role. They were being used to pave the way for a new type of empire, to lay the foundations for another wave of exploitation. The first inklings of the deception hit them when they saw that their assignment was to teach people things that those people knew more about than they did. "The Malians we worked with were farmers," Greg said. "Can you imagine the gall it takes for a U.S. agency like the Peace Corps to send a bunch of kids to tell experienced farmers how to farm their own land? How does that look to the Malians?" Despite feelings of guilt and confusion, both admitted that they had benefited immensely from their Peace Corps tours. They learned about customs, languages, and music, and about the subject they had gone there to teach, farming. "Cindy and I decided to return to Mali in 2005 with another development organization, Opportunities Industrialization Centers International, OICI, as consultants in their Farm Serve Africa program. This U.S. aid-funded organization sends American farmers who volunteer their time and skills to teach rural farmers in Africa improved agricultural techniques. I thought," Cindy said, "that this would be different from Peace Corps because by that time, I now had been a farmer. I had expertise, and I knew Mali. But to my dismay, I found that I was still participating in a top-down approach. I felt like I had stolen money from Malians who could have earned decent wages teaching the same things more effectively. Who am I? They know the market. They know so much. FarmServe spent a lot of money to get us there. Airfare, transportation, medical insurance, and some living expenses. We were supposed to be agricultural experts, consultants. But I sat in the village where I had been sent, frustrated, asking myself what I was doing. The amount of money spent on my being there in this role would support a rural Malian family for years." Their suspicions increased as they became aware of the harm caused by genetically modified organisms, GMOs, and of the collusion between U.S. agencies and the big businesses that produce and market GMOs. Farm families that had lived off the land for hundreds of years, saving seeds to replant their crops, were now becoming dependent on fertilizers, pesticides, and seeds they had to purchase from foreign companies. One evening, a large group of locals invited Greg and me to join them as they gathered around the one TV in the village. An advertisement for an anti-GMO conference showed images of Malian farmers taking to the streets in protest over the introduction of GMO crops, mainly cotton. We looked at each other and knew that we had to participate in this conference. We left the very next day. It was amazing. A week-long conference on GMO crops, cotton subsidies, and African agricultural heritage. It was attended by farmers representing Mali, Guinea, Burkina Faso, Togo, Benin, and Gambia, as well as academics, scientists, activists, and politicians. There were countless testimonials of disenfranchised farmers suffering the consequences of unfair trade policies. There was also a great deal of education about the economic, environmental, cultural, and political dangers posed by GMO crops, and many discussions around the fact that USAID and Monsanto were working together to rewrite Malian legislation. We learned directly from someone inside USAID Mali that the U.S. government agency is working with Monsanto to write into the Malian constitution language that will allow the introduction, sale, and patent rights of GMO crops. At the conference, Cindy continued, we also discovered more about the ravaging effects of U.S. cotton subsidies on Malian farmers. By allowing American farmers to sell their cotton at artificially low prices, our government undercuts African producers in world markets. African farmers often have to store their cotton for a year or more, and then may be forced to sell at rock-bottom prices or not at all. To make matters worse, our experts are persuading farmers to shift from food crops to cotton as a cash crop. In an attempt to boost production, farmers acquire seeds, pesticides, herbicides, newer plows, and fertilizer on credit, and this sends them deeper into debt to the CMDT, Compagnie Malienne pour le Développement des Textiles, which has a virtual monopoly on cotton production and marketing in Mali. The CMDT is a partnership between the Malian government and a French company, CFDT, Compagnie Française pour le Développement des Textiles. The French partners own 60% of the company. So Americans aren't alone. Greg gave the hint of a smile. After all, the French got into this business while we were still part of England. But today I'm ashamed to say our country is the leader. Participants in the conference passionately expressed their anger towards the U.S. government and transnational corporations with their manipulative policies. Fierce, heart-wrenching pain and anger. You could almost feel it in the air. It made my hair stand on end. Cindy and I concluded that economic development in Mali is driven by corporate interests. The faces of the development organizations appear benevolent. They depict themselves as aid organizations that work to improve the lives of these folks. However, the publicity campaigns serve to mask their true intentions, the control of natural and human resources, and the domination of markets. Because economic development in Mali is corporate-driven, the process is not democratic. The great majority of programs are not requested, initiated, managed, or governed by Malians. The results are often devastating, leaving Mali in worse economic and social situations than before. Furthermore, the development industry has created a large sector of highly paid foreigners who live luxurious lives and who are out of touch with the very people they're supposed to serve. On the other hand, Cindy added, the myth of development is alive and well in the USA. This myth paints a picture of people in Africa and other third world countries as ignorant, backward, helpless, stupid, and incapable of managing their own lives. That belief creates a sense of superiority and power. It generates feelings of otherness, of us versus them. Greg and Cindy told me that they intend to create a foundation dedicated to truly participatory, democratic, and sustainable development in Mali, with a focus on organic agriculture, cooperatives, and fair trade. But they will do so only if they are certain that it will be a partnership that honors Malian knowledge and wisdom. Such an organization, Cindy emphasized, would pay Africans to teach their own people. A Malian's average annual income is about $400. We figure that for the cost of a single Peace Corps volunteer to receive training, travel expenses, health coverage, and a stipend. We could pay dozens of locals a very good wage by their standards, and they would do a better job. We talked about the importance of distinguishing between NGOs that perpetuate the existing system and those that are genuinely committed to changing it. In general, Greg said, the good ones work directly with local people, the little guys. Their employees speak the language and live like their constituents. I pointed out that the best NGOs, including those discussed in the next section of this book, are often dedicated to turning corporations into good citizens through changing bylaws and operating policies. They also help the rest of us understand the implications of our lifestyles and the responsibility we have to take positive actions. We agree that while bad NGOs are servants of the empire, good NGOs offer the promise of a better world for future generations.